Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Read and Buried podcast. I'm Frankie, and I am so excited to be joined by the wonderful CL Taylor today.
Yay! Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming. I was saying before we started, I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and I've seen you on so many panels over the years, so I'm excited that I get to speak to you myself this time.
Oh, it's nice. It's nice to be on. Thank you for asking me.
No, honestly. Very, very excited. And as I say, I've seen you on so many panels talking about so many things. Your new book, I'm so excited to talk to you about. So I might just launch straight into the little bio I've got about you, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
Fantastic. Right. C.L. Taylor is the 8-time Sunday Times best-selling author of 10 gripping standalone psychological thrillers. The Accident, The Lie, The Missing, The Escape, The Fear, Sleep, not The Sleep, Strangers, Her Last Holiday, and The Guilty Couple. Her books have now sold over 2 million copies in the UK alone and have hit the number one spots on Amazon Kindle, Audible, Kobo, iBooks, and Google Play. They've been translated into over 30 languages, have been selected twice for the Richard and Judy Book Club, and optioned for television. She has also written 2 young adult thrillers, The Treatment and The Island. The Island won the Portsmouth Book Award Longer Novel in 2022 and the Warwickshire Year 9 Book Awards in 2021. That's amazing. Mm. Her latest book, Every Move You Make, is out on the 28th of March. Alexandra, Lucy, Bridget, River and Natalie, 5 friends who wish they'd never met. Because the one thing they all have in common is the worst thing in their lives. They are all being stalked. When one of their group is murdered, days after their stalker is released from prison, time stands still for them all. They know their lives could end just as brutally at any moment. All it takes is for the people they fear the most to catch up with them. When the group receive a threat that one of them will die in 10 days' time, the terror that stalks their daily lives becomes all-consuming. But they know they don't want to be victims anymore. It's time to turn the tables and finally get their revenge. Because the only way to stop a stalker is to become one yourself. Da, da, da. Very exciting. Outside of writing, Callie lives in Bristol with her husband and young son. As well as being an incredibly talented and successful writer, she also has a beautiful dog named Lily, is a self-proclaimed crochet dork, and is also very skilled at doing stunning eye makeup.
Oh, thank you.
And proving me exactly right tonight with this. Oh. This looks gorgeous and goes with your hair perfectly.
It is very matchy-matchy. Your lipstick is fabulous.
Oh, thank you. I need it to look alive because I'm so pale. Otherwise, it's just corpse chic. So,
no, I like it. The dark hair, thank you. Lips. It's really good.
Thank you very much. Oh, well, you know, this could be a great makeup podcast, but, you know. So what an incredible writing career you have had. You've always been into writing, I'm guessing, from an early age.
Yeah, I mean, you've probably had this very similar story from lots and lots of authors. But, you know, from very little, you know, as soon as I could draw and write and I was reading books, I started wanting to make them myself. So, you know, aged 8, I started to write them, illustrate books. And aged about 11, I started sending books that I'd written to Ladybird Publishers. And received my first rejection from a publisher, aged 11. I think I tried once more. I mean, I didn't even know literary agents were a thing. I thought you literally just wrote to the publisher on the back of the book. Yeah, so I tried one more time. And then when I didn't make it, aged 11, I just assumed, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe I'm not made to be an author.
Career's over. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Do you have those rejection letters still?
Luckily, I still have one and I have all the books because she's not going to thank me for this, but my mum's a massive hoarder. So she kept them all in like little clear wallets in the attic and they didn't get eaten by mice, luckily. So I have them in my house now and it is really nice to see them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's positive hoarding. So that's a nice story of hoarding.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's a good... And she must have known that you were going to become a successful writer and that one day you could look back on those.
Maybe. I think she wanted me to be a scientist, if I'm honest.
Oh, but, really?
You know, I think she's happy now.
Word scientist.
Why scientist?
A word scientist, but why as well?
Why scientist? Word scientist. No, I think author was just one of those pipe dreams. You know, like if your kid wants to be a professional footballer or or an A-list actor or those massive dreams, you know, you support your kid, but maybe realistically you think, it's a phase.
I don't have children, but I imagine it's a tricky dance between believe in yourself and you can achieve anything, but also be realistic.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Oh God. Yeah, no, I'm glad I haven't got those conversations. But, you know, especially on like World Book Day, which we are recording on, spoilers as well.
Peek
behind the curtain. It's that tricky thing where you want to encourage that passion.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a few talks at secondary schools because, as you said in the intro, I've written two young adult thrillers. And I felt like it was quite important when I was invited in to talk to the teenagers to say, you can do this. You know, if you're secretly writing a story or a novel, you could get it published. You know, I think a lot of people assume that sort of thing doesn't happen to people like them. But it absolutely does. And I think that's really important to get the word out, you know, that you don't have to have a public school education. You don't have to be posh. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to know the right people, to know anything about publishing. You can still get published.
Yeah, absolutely. I love these days. I think in particular, that's become so much more open and spoken about it's not the nepotism isn't necessary anymore, as you say.
Yes.
And having, you know, your daddy's in the same members club as the publishers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's lovely and fantastic because you get such a variety of stories that way.
Absolutely. And that's what we want, more diverse stories.
Absolutely.
And voices. Yeah.
Yes. And speaking of, you know, fascinating diverse stories, wow, every move you make is a very, very special book. And when you have a personal experience like you have with stalking, I imagine approaching this book was maybe a different beast for you compared to some of the others.
Yeah, this one was pretty intense. Mm. I mean, when I write other books, I always try and put myself in my character's shoes. I kind of call it like method writing. You become that character while you're writing their point of view, whether it's first person or third person. And you have to feel everything that they're feeling, which makes writing psychological suspense quite a stressful way to make a living.
Because, yeah, right. You
know, day after day, you're sitting at your desk going, how does it feel to be stalked? Or how does it feel to lose a loved one? Or you put yourself in all these awful, awful situations. And in a lot of them, I have to use my imagination or I have to do research. Or I often watch a lot of documentaries about whatever the subject is. Mm. But obviously with stalking, because that was something I'd experienced myself, what I could draw on, as well as doing research, because everybody's stalking experience is different. So I did watch a lot of documentaries and read news articles. I drew on my own experience. And that is intense. And I think you have to put up a mental barrier. So it's not you. This is another character. This is not you, but you put those feelings into that character, which gives you like a little bit of psychic distance from it. So I'm not writing about me all the time. In fact, the hardest thing that I found to write was the author note at the end, where I did write about my experience. And I've done two interviews with journalists where they've asked a lot of questions and I've had to delve quite deeply into the experience of being stalked. And that is more stressful, that is more intense than writing a book about it because of that distance in creating something fictional.
Yeah, and because in your author's note, it's incredibly detailed, everything that you went through. So I can imagine there was probably an element of catharsis getting it out, but then also reliving it through that writing, which is, Jesus, that's a heavy afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose, you know, you when you're writing a book, it's not just an afternoon, like it might be writing the author's note. It's between 5 and 7 months typically. And that's quite a long time. But the thing that was cathartic about writing every move you make is the whole thing about the characters taking back control.
Yes.
Because I think to be afraid and be vulnerable and always sense that someone's watching you, but the fact that these four characters decide to make a plan to take back control, that was almost like a kind of wish fulfillment. You know, when I had my stalking experience, you know, I told my sister and I told my best friend, and eventually I told my parents, but I lived alone at the time. And so much of it, I just dealt with by myself on my own. And in the book, there are four of them who meet at a stalking support group, and they're all in London, and they form this WhatsApp group. So there's always somebody to text. There's always somebody to talk to about your fear. But equally, when this group meet and get together and decide to take matters into their own hands, there's that sense of someone's going to help me. Someone's going to help me take control, because they've all been to the police. Well, a couple of them don't want to go to the police, but of those that have been to the police can't find their stalker, which isn't that unusual. You know, that happens a lot in real life.
And even the conviction rate of stalking is so low. It's so hard to prove stalking and get the evidence you need for a conviction, isn't it?
Yeah. I was researching that recently for an article I wrote. Mm. It's 1.4% of all of the people that report stalking to the police, only 1.4% actually get a prison term.
That's insane.
That's horrific. I mean, that's on a par with rape.
Yeah.
And you know, yes, men are raped. Yes, men are stalked. But the majority are women. And I think it's awful in society that these terrible crimes against women have such low conviction rates. You know, something's wrong there.
Very much so. And for a balanced view, one of your characters is a man who is stalked as well. So you do still have that representation there, because you say it does happen. But statistically, it is more women that face stalking, and especially by, and unfortunately in your experience, by ex-partners or people that they know more commonly, right?
Yeah. I mean, even since I've started talking about this on social media, so many people have DM'd me or replied to something I've posted and said, oh, I was stalked by a colleague, I was stalked by a stranger, I was stalked by an ex-partner. I mean, this is a lot of people, you know. There's a lot of things that I've talked about over the length of my career. And another one is coercive and controlling relationships. Whenever you talk about that, a lot of people come out and say it happened to them as well. But I, frankly, so far, I've been really shocked, and the book's not out yet.
Yeah.
So when it comes out, how many more people am I going to hear from? You know, it's quite terrifying.
I imagine it's going to be a lot. It's very, very scary. And I think as well, with the way that you write about the characters as well and what they go through, it's from, I was reading Goodreads earlier, which is always a bit of a dicey place to attend. But for the most part, people were saying how real it felt in terms of the stalker's experience. So I think it may even be a case of a lot of people don't even realize what they're going through is stalking, because you assume stalking is such a big label to slap on something, but it covers a multitude of sins, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. At the very beginning, you know, I was in a controlling and coercive relationship for 4 years. We didn't live together. I was in Brighton. He lived in London. So we'd kind of travel between the two to see each other, maybe stay with each other for a few days, or we went on holiday, stuff like that. Mm. And I tried to leave him multiple times over the course of 4 years, but each time he managed to talk me back. And the time when I decided, okay, that's enough is enough, I was due to hand over the keys to my flat to a letting agent. And I was going to move in with him in London. We were going to get a place together. And he texted me and started an argument with me because I hadn't kissed him goodbye that morning. And I just thought, this is going to be the rest of my life, and I'm going to be trapped. I'm going to be trapped in a flat with him. At least over the course of the last 4 years, I've always been able to escape to my flat, my safe place. I can't give that up. You know, it's enough. But I thought, when I rang him and I entered it, I thought, I cannot now answer any calls from him, respond to any texts, emails, anything, because he'll just talk me around again. Because he knows my vulnerabilities, he knows my weak spots, and he'll just use them against me to talk me around. Because he was very, very clever, very manipulative. And so I stopped. And then he started bombarding me. And initially, I just thought, he's just really frustrated because I won't respond. You know, he's just desperately trying to have the last word, or he's trying to put his case across or whatever. But then it escalates. And, you know, and when you've got them standing outside your flat, pressing the doorbell in the rain and texting you saying, I know you're in there, I can hear you moving around. You know that that has crossed over from ex-boyfriend trying to get you back to actual stalking.
Yeah, that must have been so terrifying. God,
that was horrible.
Oh, geez. I mean, you're incredibly brave to tell your story and be so open about it. And I'm sure it's going to help so many people to have you talk so openly about it. I don't doubt it. And I mean, you've obviously been a crime writer for a while. So has this story been on your mind over the years to tell, or how did you get to this point?
I've kind of sort of dipped my toe in it a little bit. I've had a little bit of a stalker subplot in Strangers, my 2020 book. But I didn't reveal to my publicist at the time that I'd had this experience, and I don't think I was ready to. But because this book is solely about stalking, I was like, you know, now is the time. This is the time to talk about it. But I think like any kind of traumatic experience, you need enough time to process it, or therapy, or or whatever it is, to be able to look at it more from, of course you can still remember the emotions it brought up in you. But I think if you're too close to anything, it's not the best time to put it into fiction. And I've seen that with some aspiring authors who've had something quite big happen in their life, and they want to write a book about it. And I always say to them, when did it happen? And if they say, oh, it happened last year or 2 years ago, I kind of think, maybe just write about something else first. Yeah. And when you've learned the craft of writing, then come back to your story with a bit of space, and you'll really do it justice then. But now there'll be too much of you in it to create the kind of narrative that a story needs.
Too raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I imagine as well, because as you've written, as you said, an incredible amount of books at this point, the process for you, you must have it kind of, is it fair to say you've got it down at this point, or is it different for every book?
I wish.
Hysterical laughter.
I absolutely wish I had it down. You know, people say, oh, it must get easier with every book. And it really doesn't, because every time you write a book, you set yourself a different kind of challenge. Mm. You know, you've still got characters in it. You've still got a crime taking place, but maybe you will try a different number of point of views, or maybe you'll have part of your story in the past tense. Or even just the plot itself, it's not like there's a formula that you can just slot it into, you know. So find the dead body, you know, find the dead body at the beginning, or discover there's a missing person. This is step one, step two, step three, just fill it in here. Doesn't work like that at all. You have to approach it differently because the characters are different, and the characters' motivations are different, and the kind of twisty, turny way that crime turns into plot is always different. I mean, even now at the moment when I'm writing the next book, which comes out in 2025, I filled up my whiteboard with loads of index cards, and you know, I had the bones of a plot, but you know, even just closing in on the 50% of the way through, the midway point now, it was only about 5,000 words ago that I thought, oh, someone has to die. You know, and I didn't know that when I was plotting it. I thought, someone has to die, because you get to know it better, because the characters come alive when you write. So that just gives you all kinds of headaches, because you're like, yes, this is good. This is really good. But now I've set myself up a bit of an issue with this character, so I'm going to have to work out blah, 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 blah. So that, and that happens with every single book. And maybe there are authors who have, and I'm sure there are, who have a cast iron plan and plot at the beginning, and they don't deviate once with one book. I read that James Patterson outlines his books, and I thought, well, James Patterson, you know, multi-millionaire or whatever, I'll give it a go. So I wrote a 13,000 word outline for one of my books, which was obviously super detailed. But by the time it came to writing the actual book, I felt like I'd already written it, and it was really boring. Yeah. So I think this way works best, even though it can be frustrating, which is a bit of planning, but allow yourself to go off course if that's what the characters want.
And I imagine as well, there is a lot of pressure on the twist in a book, right? How the dreaded words of the twist.
Mm-hmm.
And this many books in, does it get more and more pressure to have a new exciting twist, or do you kind of feel you have a rhythm for it now?
No, there's more pressure because there's not only have I done plenty of twists myself, so you don't really want to repeat yourself in the type of twist that you do. There's also so many psychological thrillers out there and so many twists that have been done and so many twists that are guessable. You know, I mean, even me as a psych thriller reader, it's so unusual for me to be caught out by a twist because I'm looking for it. And I think people who are voracious psych thriller readers are looking for it right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And you almost spoil the book for yourself when you do that. Just go into it with an open mind. Just, you know, just try and solve the mystery, but don't go looking for the twists because it's so fun. You know, when you are caught out, like the last book that did that for me was 56 Days by Catherine Ryan Howard.
Yep.
That caught me out. I wasn't looking for it. I mean, I probably shouldn't have mentioned it now. I probably spoiled it by saying that there's a twist in it. But I just went into it just open-minded and I was totally gripped by the story. And when the twist came, I was like, oh, you know. But I made the mistake of recommending it to somebody on Twitter and saying it's got a great twist. And she said to me, I always guess the twists. And then she came back and went, I guess the twist. But I think that's because I told her there was a twist.
Come on. There's always one, isn't there?
Exactly. But in terms of the twists for my own books, I very rarely have them right at the beginning. I'm quite last minute in that it will just occur to me. I mean, a twist occurred to me maybe 20,000 words through the book I'm writing now, which is quite early for me. Other books, I've thought of the twist 5,000 words before the end. And then I put the twist in. Yeah. And then I have to go back and rewrite bits. Another book, I'd actually written it. And I thought, oh, I've got an extra. And I'd already sent it to my editor to edit and said, oh, can you just hang on? I've just thought of something else. I was having a shower or something. And I wish I could start off. You know, like everybody wants editors really want high concept books with twists. And I just think if one could just pop into my head magically, here's a high concept idea and here's the ready-made twist. Now you just write towards the twist. Like that's what Sarah Pinborough did in Behind Her Eyes. She knew from the beginning what the twist is in that book and she wrote towards it. And I'm so envious of that skill because to me it's all just luck.
Well, it's definitely more than luck, I would say. It's obviously skill and ability and, you know, years of experience and all that. But no, I know what you mean. I guess it's just one of those things where if it strikes you one day, then that will be wonderful. But you're doing pretty well without it, I would say.
Yeah. Somehow, my method is working.
Method to the madness. Well, it's working very well. And with the writing process, what do you enjoy most and least about it?
So my favourite bit is the brainstorming at the beginning.
Right.
I'll get a new notebook. I'll get one from Papier and I'll put a working title on it and my name like embossed or in gold or just make it really special. And then I'll buy a new pen and then I'll brainstorm and I'll do spider diagrams and I'll write notes from documentaries I'm watching or films I'm watching. And I just kind of put everything in my head onto the page. And often I'll do that and I just won't even refer to it until I start to piece together the plot, the post-it notes. And I love doing the post-it notes as well, you know, putting it up on a board using the 4X structure. I love that kind of piecing the puzzle together, even though it goes on to change. I love that. I think it's kind of, what's the word, kinesthetic. So you're using a pen and you're touching things and moving them around. My least favorite part is edits, because you're working flat out for between 5 and 7 months writing your book. Your deadline gets closer and closer. You get more and more tired, but you're putting in more and more hours. You deliver it to your editor. You feel like, oh, I'm done. And then you get maybe 1 week, maybe 2 weeks off. And then here comes your book again. There are loads of problems. Fix them in a month. You know, and I just...
No, you don't want to.
Exactly. And, you know, I will just open the email and just swear. You know, that will be my first, and I'll look at the big long list and I just think, really? After 11 books or whatever, do I really need to? But of course I need to do all of that work, because I think you're in a danger zone as an author if you stop getting edited. Your books are over long for a start. But editors just they pick up. With me, it's mostly small things. It's sort of, you know, how long is this character been with this character, how did they meet, and you know, what is this character's motivation for doing that. They're relatively small. I don't have to restructure my whole plot, but it's still finickety and annoying.
No, I get it. And I guess to start with as well, it must be really hard to be like, hey, I spent so long on this and you're just like destroying my baby, like before my eyes. Like, what are you doing? My perfect, beautiful baby. But I guess does your skin get thicker with it as you go, or not really?
Oh, yeah. I don't cry over edits anymore. No. I have had two edits in my career where I did cry. One was my second rom-com, because I started writing romantic comedies before I turned to crime. And the other one, and it's second book syndrome, because the other one was my second crime novel.
Really?
So those were awful edits as well. And I had to create a whole new strand in the book that was 40,000 words long and cut 30,000 from the other bit. And that was a lot of work. And I did cry and feel overwhelmed, but not anymore. But often the thing is now I really trust my gut instinct. So when I deliver a book, I'll always have a bit of a feeling in my stomach, in my gut, like, or maybe it's a bit slow at the beginning, or maybe this character's motivation isn't very believable, or, you know, or maybe that's a bit coincidental. But I'll think, I'm sure it's just me being overreactive and, you know, whatever, oversensitive. And I deliver the book and my editor will point out those things and say, fix them. And I knew they were an issue to begin with, but now I have to confront them. And yeah, there's no hiding. There's no hiding for the good editor.
No. But as you say, they play such an important role, though, because I think about in film in particular, you know, when someone stops being edited as a filmmaker, when they become a genius,
yes,
and they're not edited anymore, and then their films triple in length, mm-hmm, and are just full of needless, pointless parts, you're like, this could have really done with an edit, right?
Yeah.
It does. Yeah. It is beneficial, even though it's a painful process.
Yeah, exactly. I'll always do my edits. Unless I'm like really old, and then maybe I'll just pay someone to do it for me.
Work for James Patterson.
So. Yeah, exactly.
And you touched upon with character. You said that, you know, you put a little bit of yourself into all of your characters when you write them. So I'm really curious, is if you had to be a character in one of your books, who would you be and why?
Okay, this might sound a little odd, but
okay, I like where this is going.
Yeah. In my book, Strangers, there's a character called Ursula, who is 6'3" and a kleptomaniac. And she's also a courier. She's a delivery driver. So I'm tall. So I'm just under 6 foot. So I can relate to Ursula like that. I'm not a kleptomaniac and I'm not a courier. But although Ursula has this really sad backstory that kind of drives what she does. But she's also really brave and she's really kind and she does something really important in the book. And I really admire that in her. And I admire that she's a nice person. You know, not all of my characters are nice, but Strangers is probably got the most nice characters of any of my books. And of all of them, Ursula was the one that I most loved writing. And weirdly, when I was coming up with that book, and I'd already had Ursula in my head, there was a knock at my door. It was someone with a parcel for me. It was this woman who was taller than me and looked just like I thought Ursula looked like.
No. Yeah.
And I was just like, this is really freaking.
Wow. Like, were you a bit starstruck in a weird way? Like, I know you.
Yeah, I really wanted to take a photo of her. But literally, since I never saw her again.
Oh.
So it's like a character came out of my head, turned up on my door and knocked. And then she went in my book and vanished. So weird. But she's
That's
the one
amazing.
I'm fondest of, I think. So if I had to be one, I would be the one I'm fondest of.
Wow, that's a good choice, as you say, because some of the characters you have go through some rough stuff as well, so you don't want to go through any of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Wow, I wonder if that courier was also a kleptomaniac. You have to follow her to find out. That'd be fascinating. Your package arrived intact, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, okay. I'm also really curious because I had I spoke to Simon McLeave recently, who is obviously a very prolific writer as well, similar to you. And he was saying he doesn't get writer's block ever.
Mm.
Do you get writer's block?
I hit bits of the story where I get a bit stuck because I might know what happens. So I know what happens now, and then I know a scene a bit later on, but I'm not entirely sure what happens between now and then. This is because of my very vague plotting. So I might have a pause, and often what I'll do is I'll look back at what I've already written and maybe replot. So I can see the balance of what I've already written. And that way I can work out how to fill the hole. The other thing I find really hard is writing the first chapter of a new book, because it feels like, you know, it's that fear of the blank page. And, you know, you want your first chapter to make a good impact. But equally, you don't know your characters yet. So I always say writing the first chapter of a new book is like going on a blind date. You're a bit self-conscious. You're not sure what to say. You don't know the other person. So you kind of stumble around a little bit trying to express yourself. And then eventually you'll get into your flow. And so that's it for me. I think the hardest thing I find in terms of writer's block is ideas, because I have a tick list in my head of what makes a good book. And because so much has already been written, both by me and other authors, I'm a bit like, how can I be the same but different? How can I do a different twist on this genre that's not been done yet, but is universal? It's relatable. It's high concept. The main character has a lot to lose. There's high stakes. There's a ticking clock. There's a twist. You know, my list is pretty extensive. And I have written books where I haven't been able to tick everything off that. But, you know, I'll have ideas and I'll just think, I think this might be a little bit too specialized, a little bit too out there. And not enough people or readers will be able to relate to this book. I'm quite analytical when it comes to my book's success and also the success of other authors. I try and work out what it is, other than a massive marketing budget, that makes those books successful. And a huge part of it is the relatability and the universality of the story. Like Girl on the Train, when you know, everybody looks out of a train window and looks into other people's houses, but also it's the emotion, you know, like Claire Douglas's The Couple at Number 9. That book has loads of emotion in it. And if you can nail those things, then, you know, and you've got a good marketing budget from your publisher.
That helps. Sure.
That's the secret to success. But it's hard to come up with those kinds of ideas and also be original. So,
to say the least, like, I can't even imagine. I always think of, is it South Park? When it was like Simpsons did it, you're like, someone's done it, you know, like it's always, and even if you think it's original, you know, you just never know if someone's writing the same story as you at the same time even.
Yeah. Well, when I wrote The Guilty Couple, which is about a woman who's falsely accused of trying to murder her husband, goes to jail, comes out and gets revenge, I had no idea anybody else was writing it. My book came out. Then T.M. Logan had a similar book come out.
Yeah.
Then Dorothy Coombson had a similar book that came out. And even now in the bookseller, I'm seeing somebody else has written a book about that. And I'm like, it has to be something we watched on telly. Because this also happened when I wrote Sleep, which is about a group of guests in a hotel on a Scottish island, gets cut off by a storm and there's a murderer amongst them, blah, blah, blah. And that came out in 2019. the same year, Lucy Foley wrote one.
I was going to say.
Tina wrote one.
Yeah.
And the thing that we all had in common, we'd all watched Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None on the BBC at Christmas.
Right.
So now I'm feeling like I need to watch some really obscure TV channels that nobody else watches, but we're all going to get the same ideas.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I guess because subconsciously you'll pick things up without even realizing where they've come from, right? Like we all do it. It's, you know, it's part of life. But you think, I wonder, like when you end up with a song in your head and you're like, when did I even hear that song? And then you go, oh, yeah, I did hear that actually. It's fascinating. I always think of, I forget the name, Elizabeth Gilbert. And she says about ideas as well and how they'll float around and land and...
I listened to that and I've got an idea for a non-crime idea that was inspired by a little video clip that I saw on Facebook. And I've told my agent about it and she really likes it. And I'm so scared that if I don't write it now, like literally as soon as I finish this crime book, it'll do the Elizabeth Gilbert thing and float into somebody else's head and they'll write it and I'll miss out. So fear is propelling me to write this idea because I think it's so good. And it is high concept and it has got a ticking clock and there is lots of emotion in it, but it's not crime. So
wow, exciting.
We'll see.
God, that's the thing. It's the stress of like, is someone going to get there first? I'm going to write this thing down. Like, oh my God, your own ticking clock on the ticking clock.
Yes, exactly. Oh. Exactly.
When do you sleep though?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I stay up very late.
Oh, God. Well, you're a trooper. So this is why you're successful, you see. That's because you're willing to put in the hours.
Yeah.
And with the writing, it's a question I've started asking people, which I find fascinating, is what's a line you've written lately or from across your catalogue that you're especially proud of?
Okay. I had to choose, because it was closest at hand.
Sure.
My author copies of every movie you make have literally just turned up yesterday. Mm. So I picked that up and I found a line in, I think it was chapter 3, that was, memories can't bloom if you nip them in the bud. And
that's
it was
brilliant.
About somebody starting to think about a bad experience and then stopped herself. And then I wrote, memories can't bloom if you nip them in the bud. And I quite like that because it's
like that.
Visual.
Yeah. And that I could see that on a nice cross stitch as well. You know, that's like a really, that's like a timeless kind of saying.
Or a tea towel.
You could crochet that into something, I'm sure.
I probably could.
And with like a nice floral motif. Oh, that could be really nice. You've got creative options here. That's amazing. I love that line.
Thank you.
And as you say, it's so important as a crime writer, I imagine, to keep up to date with other crime writers and the industry as a whole. And I imagine also you're probably just a big reader.
Yeah.
And you must get sent books all the time.
I do. And, you know, talking about what we've talked about in terms of psych thrillers and coming up with something original, these things come in waves of certain subjects being really popular.
Yeah.
And I am seeing a lot of a very similar kind of plot and setting and that sort of thing. But one book that absolutely blew me away recently was Blood Like Mine by Stuart Neville. And have you read it?
I haven't, but I've heard good things.
Yeah, you have to read it. It comes out in August this year. And they're being a bit vague about the kind of high concept in it, but I'm going to say it because I think they should be pushing this. It's crime, but with a vampire twist.
Susie Holliday recommended this as well.
Oh, did she?
Yeah,
she
did.
Excellent taste.
She does.
Excellent taste. And the thing is, it's set in America. Like Stuart Neville's a Northern Irish writer, but it's set in America and it's so driven by emotion and love, the love of the mother for her child. But also it's so high stakes and it's so tense. And it absolutely blew me away. I've been waiting so long for something different that I couldn't predict and that was different from everything else that I'd read. And he absolutely nailed it, loved it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's moved to the top of my list. Got to get my hands on a copy of that. That sounds incredible. Anything with a bit gothy and weird is always fun as well.
Yeah.
Callie, I'm having such a lovely time chatting to you that it's such a shame that I now have to confront you about a terrible thing that you've done.
Oh?
She looks very nervous. Quite, yes. You should be nervous because this is why Unfortunately, Callie, lovely C.L. Taylor, wonderful, lovely person, very talented writer, but unfortunately, you have committed a crime so terrible, so shocking, so heinous in nature that unfortunately, you've been sentenced to death. I know.
How do you think what I've done?
Well, that's the question. First question is, what do you think you've done? Maybe you are a kleptomaniac, actually, and you've been downplaying it this whole time. Maybe you stole that courier's life or something, you know, a bit of identity theft. I don't know. What do you think you've done to end up on death row?
It would definitely be revenge. It would nice. Be a revenge murder. It would be a revenge murder, or it would be, no, it would still be revenge. If something happened to anybody that I loved, I would willingly go to prison for revenge.
That's fair.
If I ever do anything, you can't use this podcast as evidence.
No, this is not admissible in court, surely not. No, okay. I'll have your back. I'll be a character witness on that. No problem. Yeah. Wink. So, okay. I'm sure it was a very noble reason. I don't doubt it. You seem very nice. And I completely had your back in the court. But unfortunately, you did get convicted. And... Mm-hmm. The death sentence has been passed down, but hey, it's not all bad because I can get you the death row meal of your dreams.
Woohoo!
Hooray! It's all worth it. Totally worth it. So what would your death row meal be?
It would have to be nachos with all the stuff as starter. So we're talking sour cream, guacamole, jalapenos, salsa, lots of melted cheese. That would be my starter. My main course would be a fillet steak with peppercorn sauce, triple fried chips, creamy spinach, random, but I really like it with a steak.
Delicious, yeah.
And totally not connected to the meal, but it's one of my favourite things if it's done well, garlic bread.
Oh,
so, yeah, that would be it. And then for pudding, it would have to be a sour cherry panna cotta.
Oh, that sounds phenomenal. That sounds like the best menu ever.
And a nice Merlot to wash it down, yeah. I don't know if they give you booze, but they should.
Well, I'll sneak in a bottle for you. That's fine.
Okay, lovely. Thanks.
The least I can do. Wow. So I'm starving now after that. Jesus' torture. I have some questions about the garlic bread. When you say a garlic bread done well, what is your definition of a good garlic bread?
Okay, this is actually my own recipe passed down from my mother. So, yeah, you get a French baguette. You cut it long ways first. You mash up the butter with garlic, fresh garlic, but through a squeezer, and you mix the butter and the garlic, and then you spread it thickly, and then you cut it downwards in like little slices, wrap it up in tin foil, cook it in the oven. The butter seeps into the French stick and it is just gorgeous.
Oh, I think I dribbled a little bit. That sounds incredible. That sounds really, really good. Okay, I'm going to have to try that. That sounds really, really nice. Wow. Okay. What a meal. And the best part is you get to breathe garlic all over the people that put you to death. So another little revenge plot from you there. I see what you did. Very
revenge.
Good.
Yeah.
Revenge. She breathes onto the person. I don't know what method we're going to use for it. Do you have a preference for death row method?
With my death?
Yeah.
Oh, lordy.
You don't have to. You can be dealer's choice if you like, but I'll give you the option.
they're all pretty awful, aren't they?
They're all quite bad, yeah. Famously quite bad.
Yeah, I mean, and they can all go a bit wrong.
That's the problem.
I'd probably go with hanging, but only if done really well.
Okay, you know? We'll get the finest hangman in the land to do it.
Actually, beheading. No, that goes wrong as well, doesn't it? Guillotine.
And very French Revolution. That's quite classy. I like that. That's nice. Yeah, I always think it's really tough, isn't it? I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for just a firing squad sometimes, but it's it's quite hard. Yeah.
This is not something I've ever considered.
Is it not? Oh, yeah, no, me neither.
I don't believe you.
It's the nature of the podcast, unfortunately. And I keep having all these authors come on who've committed terrible crimes. So I don't know. What am I to do?
What are the chances?
I know, very strange. But the sad news is you are now dead. I'm really sorry.
Okay.
I'm very, very sad. But more good news. Good news, question mark. I will bury you with the book of your choice. So...
Oh, lovely. I'll get a lot of reading done in a coffin.
Well, this is the thing. It's really interesting, this question, because people take it in different ways. Like, some people are like, oh, I'll read it on the way down the River Styx. It can be a nice little accompaniment. Some people are like, oh, will I get to read it in the afterlife? Other people are like, will I just look good when I'm dug up? And people think that I've got like a very fancy choice of books. She must have been classy kind of thing.
Interesting.
So many different ways to interpret it. Yeah,
so I'm going to go with a little bit of an irony for my answer. So the first rom-com that I wrote was called Heaven Can Wait. So I think if that was in my coffin.
Like that.
Yeah, a bit late. Heaven can't wait, unless I've gone to hell. But
I just think
that would be quite funny if you were dug up and you were holding Heaven Can Wait.
I love that. I love the thought for the people digging you up. You want to give people a laugh, you know? That's very thoughtful of you.
Exactly. It would need to be, bound in resin or something to make it last. But,
okay, I'll bind it in resin. I like that. I like humour with it. Like, with the Spike Milligan thing, you want to make people laugh at your day. Like, she was funny. That was cool. I like that.
Yeah, that'd be good. Works for me.
Okay, brilliant choice. Absolutely love that. Well, Callie, I've had such a wonderful time chatting to you. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. Where can people follow you online?
You can follow me on Twitter, now known as X, which is at Callie Taylor. I've got different names for everything. I've been around that long. My Facebook is Callie Taylor Author. My Instagram is CL Taylor Author. And I've got a slightly defunct YouTube. Not defunct, but I don't update it much, which is also CL Taylor Author. Yeah, nice. There's a little bit of writing advice on there if that's what people are after. And I've got a newsletter on my website, cltaylorauthor.com, and you get a free ebook if you sign up.
Amazing. God, well done for remembering all of them. That's pretty impressive. That's a skill in itself. So
there's even more. There's Threads and Blue Sky, but I can't be bothered.
All those. There's just too many these days is the bloody problem. Yeah, and you went every bloody day.
There is.
Every Movie Maker is out on the 28th of March.
That's right, yeah. In hardback, ebook, and audio.
Perfect. Oh, how's the audio book? I have to check that out next. That's exciting.
Oh, that's Claire Corbett. She's so good. And she messaged me and she went, I am loving doing this. I'm having so much fun with it.
That's what you want to hear.
I might have to listen to my own audio book. But she's so good. Highly recommended.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so, so much. And I'm so excited to see the reaction to this book. I think it's going to be, really, really important. And, as well as a compelling read, it's such an important message in it. So, thank you for writing it.
Yeah, thank you for reading it and talking about it. It's been great.
Oh, thank you. And thank you to everyone for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode. But before then, Callie, another thing I can never do on this podcast is end an episode. I'm terrible at it. How shall we wrap this conversation up?
Well, I would suggest with a song, but I'm terrible at singing.
I'll be the judge of that.
Okay, how about a joke? Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Europe.
Europe who?
No, Europe who?
I walked straight into it. Perfect. All right, well, that's perfect. Bye.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while reveling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule wherever you get your podcasts.